The United States responded in many ways to the attacks of September the 11th, 2001, measures ranging from tougher airport security to the arrest of thousands in search of an al-Qaeda sleeper cells. U.S. armed forces invaded Afghanistan reactively and Iraq preemptively. Many argue that much of this is an unjustified overreaction that violates the rights of citizens and non-citizens alike and undermines the principles of a liberal democracy. Others argue just as passionately that the first duty of government is to provide security and that limited restrictions of civil liberties are more than justified. In an attempt to address political ethics in an age of terror, historian and novelist Michael Ignatieff has turned to the lessons of the past. How have other states responded to these kinds of attacks? Is there a balance between pragmatism and principle? What are the goals of terrorism? How much of a threat does it actually pose to liberal democracies? And when are democracies either justified or wise to restrict civil liberties? Is torture always wrong? Is preventive detention sometimes acceptable? If you have questions about the lessons of history from Tsarist Russia and Weimar Germany to Northern Ireland and Sri Lanka, or about what we've all experienced since 9/11, our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. The email address is totn@npr.org. Michael Ignatieff is director of the Carr Center for Human Rights Policy at Harvard University. His new book is titled The Lesser Evil, Political Ethics in an Age of Terror. And he joins us now from the studios of member station WBUR in Boston. And it's good of you to be with us today.
Nice to be here.
You argue that terrorism, historically, has worked better as a tactic than as a strategy. What did you mean by that?
Well, I think if you look at the history of terrorist attacks in liberal democracies, they've never succeeded strategically in the sense that they've never cracked and brought down a liberal democracy. The closest you could say to their being successful was against Weimar Germany, which was assailed by political terrorist attacks from the left and the right, but I think was only brought down by a world depression. I mean, that is to say, when you sum it all up, liberal democracy has proven much more robust, a much tougher opponent of terror than we sometimes assume.
And given that, do liberal democracies overreact to terrorist threats? And if they do, why?
I think almost inevitably democracies overreact. We overreacted to what we thought was a terrorist threat during the Red Scare of 1919, and we've overreacted successively to emergency crises. That's partly for good reasons. That is to say, we can't anticipate how bad a problem's going to be, so we round up the usual suspects until we can figure out just how bad the problem is. That is to say, people who criticize this or any other administration for overreacting probably underestimate the degree to which we're bound to overreact. That doesn't justify overreaction. In fact, I wish we learned the lessons of history a little better, which is to bring our evaluation of risk and our reaction into better alignment.
In important ways, you say the lesson that we should learn is embodied by the tale of Ulysses and his experiences with the sirens.
Well, that's a famous story. It's kind of the great metaphor of the law. That is, in your learned listeners will doubtless know the story. Ulysses gets word that there are going to be these sirens up ahead that are going to lure his crew onto the rocks with their wonderful, delicious cries. God, I wonder what they were like. They must have been completely irresistible. Anyway, Ulysses stops his ears with beeswax, or stops the ears of his crew with beeswax so they won't row onto the rocks. And he then ties himself to the mast and allows himself to listen. But it's this idea of tying yourself to the mast with pre-commitments so that you can withhold temptation in times of danger that kind of encapsulates the idea of the rule of law. We make rules before emergencies to guide us in emergencies and prevent us from succumbing to the temptation of the sirens.
Yet you also write, and I think it's Justice Jackson's famous phrase, the Constitution is not a suicide pact. We don't know at the time what the risks are sometimes, and maybe some reactions that look like overreactions in retrospect at the time seem perfectly reasonable.
Yes, the most controversial example of that is the very extensive Palmer raids and deportations of aliens in late 1919, early 1920.
Named after then Attorney General Mitchell Palmer.
Exactly. Those look totally excessive in retrospect, but at the time, the U.S. government felt it faced a global communist conspiracy. There had been serious terrorist attacks in Wall Street. Mitchell Palmer's own house had been bombed. That's the problem. It's inherently difficult to get reaction and response into balance. Similarly, after 9/11, we held as material witnesses or on immigration violations about 5,000 Arab and Muslim visitors to the United States and some citizens. You can just justify their temporary detention. What then went completely overboard and was wrong, as David Cole and other civil libertarians have pointed out, was we held them for, 90 days. They were denied full due process. They were deported in secret hearings. That's when we made, I think, serious mistakes that have earned us, I think, a lot of justified scorn in the Arab and Muslim communities in the United States.
The key for a liberal democracy, and you're talking about civil liberties here, is the adversarial review, the idea that the legislature, the courts, the free press will be free to question the policies of the government.
Yeah, I think the key issue in a war on terror for a democracy is to safeguard the viability and vitality of checks and balances, because the chief historical impact of terrorism on democracy has been to strengthen the power of the president, the prime minister, the chief executive. And so, and the reasons for this are obvious. You want decisive, quick action. You turn to the president to respond to the threat. And in the process, you do damage to the thing that makes us free, namely adversarial review by the Congress, by the federal courts, by the Supreme Court, and not a minor issue at all, a free press. It's keeping the viability of adversarial review that's the key to keeping us free.
Michael Ignatieff is the author most recently of The Lesser Evil, Political Ethics in an Age of Terror. When we come back from a short break, we'll take your calls, 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. Email us, TOTN at NPR.org. This is NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. We're discussing politics and political ethics in uncertain times. Our guest is Michael Ignatieff, the director of the Carr Center for Human Rights Policy, the author of The Lesser Evil, Political Ethics in an Age of Terror. If you'd like to join the conversation, our number is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. The email address is TOTN at NPR.org. And let's take a question from Don, who's with us on the line from Columbia, South Carolina.
Yes. How will this war end? I mean, the so-called war on terrorism. If I ain't mistaken, or if I'm not mistaken, terrorism is a concept, the way I understand it. How do you end a concept or someone's disenfranchised with someone else?
I think that's a very good question. And what troubles us all about a war on terror is that it's not like the Second World War, which ends in unconditional surrender and defeat of the other side. This is a war that stretches before us, and I think the best we can hope is not for victory, an unconditional surrender, but get the condition to go into remission. I think it is possible for us to disrupt, divide, capture, and eliminate the Al-Qaeda leadership that led the 9/11 terrorist attacks, and I don't think anything other than a military and combat solution is possible there. But terrorism, as you were implying, is a tactic of political choice wherever people feel injustice and grievance and hurt and oppression. The Palestinians aren't turning to terror because they just feel like it. They're turning to it as a result of a feeling long endured of oppression. This is not in any sense to justify the terrorism. I detest it, but the terrorism in Palestine would end, in my judgment, or most of it would end, if the Palestinians had a viable, contiguous, joined-up state of their own on the West Bank and Gaza. And until they get that, unfortunately, regrettably, the terrorism will continue. So there are political solutions that will stop terrorism or bring it at least to an end, and some of the terrorism that we're facing, the religious, apocalyptic terrorism of al-Qaeda, just simply has to be beaten militarily and politically.
I should say that in his book, Michael Ignatieff goes to great lengths to define terrorism as a tactic used for a variety of different means or different political goals, initially as a tool of anarchists and communists, for the most part, secular, and these days most often used in a religious context.
Yes, and in many cases, terrorism is connected to very determinate and obvious political goals. The Algerians rose up against the French and used terror to get the French out of Algeria. Once the French were out of Algeria, the terrorism stopped. So it isn't the case that wars on terror are indefinite or open-ended. To the degree that the grievances that terrorism feeds on are met, terrorism will go, as it were, into recession. But we need to remember that terrorism is a permanent temptation in the political life of the modern world. That is to say, every time it appears that you can't prevail by democratic means or peaceful means, people will be tempted to turn to terrorist violence. It's the shortcut of all shortcuts in modern politics, and it will be a permanent temptation. We will never see the end of terror. There's no possible future in which terrorism will not remain a menace to the United States and other free states.
Don, thank you.
Thank you.
Let's go now to Ron, and Ron's with us from Stevensville, Michigan.
Yeah, I just wanted to say that the world is a dangerous place. It always will be. And freedom, by its definition, is risky. Just getting in my car driving down the road is dangerous, and it's my right to do so. And as a free citizen, I'm so sick of politicians taking rights away from us for our own good. I'd rather live with danger and freedom than with neither. I saw those towers collapsing on 9/11. The first thing I thought was, well, there go our civil rights with those towers. I just wanted to make that comment.
I think that's a great comment, actually. I think that one of the things we should resist is the idea, the delusive idea, that we can have total security without risk. The issue is to balance risk and rights, to do enough to reduce risk without endangering rights. We've put in some security measures at airports that have a broad degree of consensus and acceptance in American society. But there's a whole other set of measures that we could easily get into, like the indefinite detention of Arab and Muslim citizens and visitors to the United States, that would go completely over the other side. And one of the ways we'd be tempted to take those measures would be because we'd had this delusive idea to be secure at all costs, no matter what the cost is to civil liberties. We must refuse that. That's why I strongly agree with your. It's not merely that we have to defend our rights. It's also that we have to accept living with a certain element or degree of risk.
And it's too bad that politicians gain by fostering this kind of fear. Because if they can promote the fear, they can get reelected. And it's just, the whole situation is despicable.
Well, one of the things you write about... go ahead, Michael, I'm sorry.
Look, people are always going to exploit fear. There's no point going after politicians. Politicians are politicians. They do what they do the way basketball players play basketball. They exploit popular emotion for their own gain. We can't expect that to be any different. The one thing I would say is this, that it is not the case that, in general, the risks posed by al-Qaeda are being exaggerated. I think, in general, the political leadership of the country, I'm not making a partisan point here, is roughly accurate about how serious the risk is. We're not going to get anywhere in the debate if we pretend that the risk has been systematically inflated. 9/11 was the most serious attack on the country, since Pearl Harbor. It was a serious attack. The risks that this al-Qaeda gang present to us is a serious risk. What follows, however, is, as you say, the fact that it's a serious risk doesn't mean we should throw out the Constitution and Bill of Rights.
One of the things you write about is that from a politician's point of view, the risks of not doing enough and in the face of a possible second attack are considerably less than the risks of perhaps doing too much.
Yeah, the political system rewards overreaction because any politician wants to go to the country saying, better safe than sorry. And so overreaction is rewarded rather than underreaction. A politician, no politician, regardless of party, would be able to survive a second attack and the charge that he hadn't done enough to protect the country. That's why everybody's bound to overreact. The issue, in fact, in the United States since 9/11, many people say who've looked at Homeland Security closely, is we're still not doing enough about certain things, holes that we need to plug, like the security of those containers that flow across our borders, those sealed containers. That's an area where we're not doing enough. Are we securing our critical infrastructure, our power plants and all that stuff? I'm no expert here, but I have a feeling that part of the story here is we still haven't done enough to harden the targets we need to harden. And our first responders getting enough help and assistance to deal with catastrophic attack. My view is that we still need to put some dollars there. Again, I'm not trying to scare people or scaremonger, but we need to have sober, careful estimation of where our vulnerabilities are and then plug them.
An email question from Robert in Salt Lake City, Utah. I lived in Peru for about 2 years and was there when Alberto Fujimori left the presidency. Interestingly, when his replacement took office and began to relax state security against the terrorism of the Shining Path guerrillas, there were some terrorist acts that began in the jungle towns where the terrorists had been very powerful before Fujimori. I was wondering if your guests could comment on any lessons we could learn from Peru's dealing with their terrorists.
Well, I love being an expert on every subject, including Peru, and I have to have secondhand knowledge here. My beloved brother was an aid worker in Peru and handed out shovels in an agricultural project in a Peruvian village and came back 6 months later to discover that the shovels had been used to bury victims of Shining Path terror. So I know how vicious Shining Path terror is, and I think the Fujimori story tells us you have to strike hard and with courage. And the key break in the Shining Path story was that they captured Guzman, the leader, and that seems to have broken the back of it. I think one of the bigger, broader lessons of Shining Path terrorism, and it's a broad lesson, is that there was a period in the 70s, 80s, and 90s in which one person's terrorism was another person's freedom fighter, and there were certain people who regarded Shining Path and their other guerrilla movements in Latin America as being kind of leftist, authentic, progressive, pro-peasant, when in fact what they actually did was kill a lot of peasants, terrorize the population. I think one lesson we need to draw from this is a terrorist is a terrorist is a terrorist, and a terrorist is anyone who deliberately targets and kills civilians for political purposes and who's a non-state actor. And I actually endorse the view that anyone who uses those terrorist methods does not deserve to be called a freedom fighter, and there is some tendency still in a few minds to relativize terror and to accept it. And Shining Path got more benefit of the doubt outside Peru than it ever deserved.
Let's go to Paul, and he's on the line from Rockland, California.
Yes. I would like to know how you define terrorism. Is it part of it outmining a harbor of a country you're not at war with? Or?
That would have been a tactic the United States used in Nicaragua.
Right. And also sending guerrillas in to subvert the country that we armed.
The Contras, again, in Nicaragua, I think.
That's right. Now, is that terrorism or is that just politics?
Well, look, I think there was a great 18th century philosopher who said, everything is what it is and not another thing. I used terrorism to describe acts of political violence against civilians conducted by non-state actors. Hang on. Let me just get to the point. This is not to condone acts of the kind you describe, in which states subvert other states, arm insurrectionaries, mine harbors. These are violations of the sovereignty of the state. They are violations of international law. They may be acts of state terror. I'm simply trying to use terrorism to describe those activities of terror conducted by non-state actors. It's a definitional point. It's not a moral point. That is, if your moral point is, hasn't the United States done some terrible things? Sure. I just think they're different from what we definitionally call terrorism.
One distinction you do draw in the book is the distinction that states, and you use the example in this argument of Israel, where things go wrong, torture and that sort of thing, at least those actions are open to adversarial review, in this case by the courts, sometimes stopped, as opposed to the actions of non-state terrorists who aren't under any review whatsoever.
Yeah, I don't want to give anybody a free pass here. I don't want to excuse the United States by my definitions, and I hope my listener doesn't take it as an excuse. I don't like what was done in Nicaragua any more than he does. As for Israel, I don't want to excuse Israel for violations of the laws of war, illegal killing of civilians, illegal dynamiting of houses, which we've just seen in Rafah refugee camp. But the point I would make is that the state of Israel subjects its armed forces and its security services to the adversarial review of a democratic state. The Supreme Court has recurrently ruled, for example, on the issue of torture and attempted to subject security policy to the review of a democratic state. There is no equivalent review of the terrorist activities of the Palestinian side, precisely because there isn't a Palestinian state. One of the cases you can make for a Palestinian state is it would begin to establish control, a monopoly over the means of violence on the Palestinian side. And so those who equate Israeli violence and Palestinian violence often don't give enough attention to these very real differences in accountability on both sides.
We're speaking with Michael Ignatieff. His new book, The Lesser Evil, Political Ethics in the Age of Terror. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And let's get a call in from Kurt, who's with us from Eugene, Oregon.
Hi, thank you for your call. I am also interested in this notion of adversarial review. And the last caller mentioned Nicaragua and other incidences by states. What were some forms of adversarial review that were in place prior to the war on terror, for instance, the World Court and the United Nations and that thing? And don't we do have a free pass if, for instance, Chalabi can, you know, be convicted by a military court and thus, oh, well, we can still work with him because, you know, he wasn't convicted by a civilian court? I mean, it seems to me that that provides the free pass for us to do what we want without any system of adversarial review.
Mm-hmm. Look, what do I mean by adversarial review? I simply mean that Congress holds hearings, brings executive practice under scrutiny, free press does its job, the courts operate properly. Let me give you a practical example of that. Supreme Court of the United States is reviewing the detention of an American citizen on a Navy brig, Mr. Padilla. It's going to hand down a ruling on that shortly. That's adversarial review of executive power. Congress has been holding hearings on the Abu Ghraib scandal. That is adversarial review. The 9/11 Commission is subjecting the president's conduct prior to 9/11 to adversarial review. And all of this is in open and in public. And my view is that this will strengthen our democracy. Now, if the Supreme Court decides that the president does have the power to indefinitely detain an American citizen without trial, that will be, in my view, a mighty blow to the constitutional fabric of adversarial review and a mighty blow to the civil liberties of every single American citizen. But I don't want to give up on the vitality of our institutions, which are trying to regulate a war on terror publicly. Now, you mentioned some international parts of adversarial review, which are important. That's what we have the United Nations for, to subject the use of force by the United States to the adversarial review of what we call the UN Security Council. Now, we know how that went. The United States proceeded against the Security Council's view and will and got into the difficulties we now see. My point is that I think, in fact, that within our democracy and in the international arena, presidential power is subjected to a buffeting. And my whole point of my book is to say we ought to give it more of a buffeting, more of a tough time, more pressure, more public criticism.
Kurt?
My criticism, I suppose, is that, you know, people that lose hope and then have been subjected to you know, us funding groups that somehow did some nefarious activities, and there's all kinds of examples of that, They do not, you know, that when you lose hope, then your only other course of action is to take those other actions that you know, got us into the position that we are now. I'd like to see some action taken to bring about a check and balance on not just our nation, on all nations. And I think that would go a long way to helping these people that have differences with us and our style of government to see that, yes, we are indeed serious about justice. You know, you hear an awful lot that we're a country of laws, but when you can turn around and point to, oh, well, that law, we're just not going to follow that one this time, then you know, people have a problem, then they turn to a course of action that's much more violent.
Kurt, thanks very much for the call. We'll continue to discuss these issues and others with Michael Ignatieff, the author of The Lesser Evil, Political Ethics in an Age of Terror, when we come back from a break. Also, your letters and your phone calls, 800-989-8255, email totn@npr.org. I'm Neil Conan, Talk of the Nation, NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Today we are talking with Michael Ignatieff and talking about the Lesser Evil, Political Ethics in an Age of Terror. That's his new book. Michael Ignatieff is an historian. He is also a broadcaster and director of the Carr Center for Human Rights Policy at Harvard University, a novelist as well. If you have questions about the definitions of terrorism, about the challenges facing civil liberties in the United States or the historical examples of terrorism in other states, including this one at other times. Our number is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. Our email address is totn@npr.org. And Michael Ignatieff, we an email from Leah. The person who just called us, speaking of an earlier caller, said he saw the towers fall on 9/11 and said, there go our civil rights. I would like to ask, what civil rights has he lacked since 9/11? Not until this hits us all in the gut will everyone get off their academic theorizing, pontificating, and philosophizing and do what needs to be done to win this struggle. My sister and niece are flying to Europe next week. It is already hitting me in the gut.
Yeah, I think that's one of the realities since 9/11, that you have to be a Arab foreigner in the country on a student visa. You have to be a Muslim on a lapsed visa of some other kind. You have to be a very small category of persons to feel the war on terror at all. But the Lackawanna defenders in Buffalo know all about the war on terror. The detainees post 9/11 know a lot about the war on terror. Part of what makes getting a grip on this issue tough is that it's not impacting on us directly, except when we go to an airport and pass through a security screen. And that's why the challenge of defending civil liberties at the moment is defending other people's liberties, sometimes non-citizens' liberties, so that eventually when they come for us, we've got the bulwark and defenses established. And that's, I think, the thing we have to get in our gut is the issue that there is an indivisibility and unity of citizenship and rights in this country that all of us have an interest and a moral duty to defend. And if you don't think they're in danger, you ought to read the front page of the Wall Street Journal today, in which, you know, the senior lawyers at the Department of Defense basically sat down in late 2002 and 2003 and constructed a very elaborate, very ingenious justification for the use of abusive interrogation techniques that amounted to torture, and parsed the torture conventions, all the conventions the United States has clearly signed, in such a way as to provide excuses for the interrogators who conduct these operations. And so when people say Abu Ghraib was just a bunch of bad apples, they really need to look at the ways in which adversarial review failed at the highest levels of our government, namely in the Department of Defense Office of Legal Counsel, which ought to be in the business not of permitting torture, but trying to prevent it and forbid it and set out clear guidelines that punish those who engage in it. When torture is done in the name of America, no matter how far away, it disgraces every American. And the strategic consequences, as we've seen throughout the Middle East, are catastrophic.
One of the things you point out is that history suggests that terrorism does not threaten liberal democracies, at least nowhere near to the extent that liberal democracies overreact to it and thereby undermine their own principles. Yet the essence of the state is not at risk. You point out the comparison that many of us made to Pearl Harbor after 9/11, and that al-Qaeda's resources are vastly less than the resources of the Empire of Japan. Yet, in a world where perhaps al-Qaeda or other nihilistic terrorists could acquire nuclear, chemical, biological weapons, do those principles still stand?
I think this is what makes the 21st century terrorism disturbingly unlike the terrorism that liberal democracies have successfully defeated in the 20th century. And that's simply that the ultimate weapons of mass destruction are slipping out of the control of the state into the hands potentially of terrorist actors. If it hasn't happened already, it is bound to happen. If you look at what happened when the chief nuclear scientist of Pakistan basically ran a kind of private for-profit trade in nuclear secrets, you can begin to see how the state's monopoly over these weapons begins to break down. And if they are found in the hands of Osama bin Laden, then we're in a very dangerous situation precisely because he can't be deterred and contained the way a holder of state power can be deterred or contained. This guy doesn't care about dying, and he doesn't care about bringing a whole lot of people with him, provided he secures these apocalyptic goals he has. And that's what makes this terrorism, the terrorism of the 20th century, dangerous. Apocalyptic political goals, destruction of the United States, married to, you know, nuclear, chemical, and biological technologies. That makes it different than what we faced in the last century.
As you look at the near future, the many people say another attack on the United States is not a matter of if, but a matter of when. This may be the quietest moment we get to reflect on what we should do in the event of another attack before there is one. This is the moment when perhaps we can, like Ulysses, stuff beeswax in the ears of our crewmen and lash ourselves to the mast to avoid the temptations of what happens next. If there's another attack on the scale of 9/11, something like that, what fear can happen? What we should we do now to prevent overreaction in those circumstances?
Well, we need to look at the history. We need to look, for example, at the mass internment of Japanese citizens during the Second World War by great President Roosevelt. We need to look at that, realize that it served no strategic or military purpose, and therefore not go there. That is, mass internment, mass incarceration of categories of citizens was a mistake in the past. It'll be a mistake in the future, since presuming that that mass detention will apply to Muslim or Arab citizens or people whose country of origin is the Middle East, 99% of those people have no desire other than to live a quiet and peaceful life in the United States. Detaining them will simply serve no strategic purpose. So that's one negative lesson. Let's learn from the past and not make the mistakes that we've made in different circumstances. It's mostly negative mistakes. The other thing is to, as I've said, we need to strengthen democratic government. We need to have more open government, not more secret government. We need to have a more robust Congress, a more interventionist court. We need to put presidential power under scrutiny. We need to understand what it is we're defending, because when we're attacked, all we'll care about is we'll hunker down, we'll get frightened, we'll allow fear to drive the public policy agenda, and that would be a disaster. And we need to be very clear, and this is where the Madrid bombing in Spain in March is such a telling pointer. Terrorists will seek to alter and impact the democratic process itself, and we must be very aware that that is what their intention is, and make absolutely sure that our voting preferences in November, were God help us an attack to occur, are not impacted by a terrorist attack. Because to have them impacted by fear, to have them impacted by rage and revenge, would essentially hand terrorists the victory, because they would have succeeded in actually warping a democratic outcome, as I believe they did in Spain in March of this year.
Michael Ignatieff, thank you very much for coming in today.
pleasure.
Michael Ignatieff's book is called The Lesser Evil, Political Ethics in an Age of Terror, and he joined us from the studios of member station WBUR in Boston. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News.